You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know. But after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking to Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
A doomsday cult that led its followers to take their own lives in order to meet up with a comet that was passing by Earth. It happened, and the result was 39 people dead and several others brainwashed and accessories to a crime. Today, Marshall Applewhite and the story of Heaven's Gate cults.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Marshall Herf Applewhite Jr., also known as Dew, among other names, was an American cult leader who founded what became known as the Heaven's Gate religious group and organized their mass suicide in 1997, claiming the lives of 39 people. A native of Texas, Applewhite attended several universities and as a young man served in the United States Army. After finishing school at Austin College, he taught music at the University of Alabama. He later returned to Texas, where he led courses and served as a chair of the music department at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. He left the school in 1970, citing emotional turmoil. His father's death a year later brought on severe depression. In 1972, he developed a close friendship with Bonnie Nettles, a nurse, and together they discussed mysticism at length and concluded that they were called as divine messengers. They operated a bookstore and teaching center for a short while and then began to travel around the U.S. in 1973 to spread their views. They once gained one convert, and in 1975, Applewhite was arrested for failing to return a rental car and was jailed for 6 months. In jail, he further developed his theology. After Applewhite's release, he traveled to California and Oregon with Nettles, eventually gaining a group of committed followers. Applewhite and Nettles told their followers that they would be visited by extraterrestrials, who would provide them with new bodies. Applewhite initially stated that his followers and he would physically ascend to the spaceship, where their bodies would be transformed, but later he came to believe that their bodies were the mere containers of their souls, which would later be placed into new bodies. These ideas were expressed with language drawn from Christian astrology and New Age movements and American popular culture. The group received an influx of funds in the late 1970s, which it used to pay housing and other expenses. In 1985, Nettles died, leaving Applewhite distraught and challenging his views on physical ascension. In the early 1990s, the group took more steps to publicize their theology. And in 1996, they learned of the approach of the comet Hale-Bopp and rumors of an accompanying spaceship. They concluded that this spaceship was the vessel that would take their spirits on board for a journey to another planet, believing that their souls would ascend to the spaceship and be given new bodies. The group members died by mass suicide in their mansion. A media circus followed the discovery of the bodies, and in the aftermath, commentators and academics discussed how Applewhite persuaded people to follow his commands, including suicide. Some commentators attributed his father's willingness to die by suicide to his skill as a manipulator, while others argued that their willingness was due to their faith and the narrative that he constructed. So this is, of course, the dark side of Wikipedia. Going into the dark story, and we're going to construct the life here of the Marshall Applewhite Wikipedia entry, which, of course, is all about him and the Heaven's Gate cult. But it's interesting, because I'm very, very fascinated by the idea of these cult leaders and how they do what they do. So someday I can start a cult too. Okay, no, not really. But I'm just amazed by what one is able to do and the persuasion that some people have. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, I found it difficult, you know, just to persuade someone to listen to a podcast or to a radio station. More or less, let's devote your life to a new theology that I just happened to tell you about from the back of my Buick as I was driving through Oregon. You know, it's just, it's fascinating to me what the human mind is capable of just accepting and saying, yep, that's okay. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you on today's episode of The Dark Side.
And what years did that, when did it start again?
It started in the 70s, I believe, and then 97 is when it officially ended, or at least that incarnation of it ended, because that's when, you know, yeah, they all kind of died.
But two things. One is that I think in the 70s was a particularly different time, mm-hmm. because a lot of people were smoking weed and they're like looking for something more meaningful to life. And it was just a different time. Mm-hmm. So I think that people were more open to hearing someone out, mm-hmm. you know, in like you could get wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
How you could go, Halley's Comet, and there's a spaceship, we're getting on it. Like, I don't get that leap.
Yeah.
But I do kind of get that whole how you could.
I get the, you know, spiritualism. I'm looking to find something. I'm at one with the universe and the world and that sort of stuff. When you connect the spaceship to the comet that you just randomly made up, that's...
And that doesn't happen right away, because what's really weird... So I never know what we're going to talk about in these episodes. And always right before we start, I'm like, what are we going to talk about? Mm-hmm. I've done no research ever. And what's crazy is I got my hair cut for the second time last week, this entire year. And my hairdresser, for some reason, I think we're talking about the Nexium mm-hmm. podcast, which you and I did a week ago.
Yeah.
And we're talking about that. And then my hairdresser says, yeah, so my friend's mom was in a cult. And I'm like, what cult was it? And she goes, oh, God, it was one. And there was a spaceship. And she stops cutting my hair and gets out her phone. And I'm like going, oh, I heard a podcast or watched a show on these people.
Yeah.
I couldn't think. And she's like, Heaven's Gate. And I'm like, that's it. So her friend's mom was in Heaven's Gate.
Was she one of the 39 who died, or did she get out before?
So apparently her and her sister moved out to California, wherever they encountered all these people. And I think they got out there and the sister left this woman. Mm-hmm. And then she ended up meeting these people. And it's kind of a slow indoctrination.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think that's how they started. It's a community. It's a family. Mm-hmm. You know, here she is by herself looking for, you know, something to belong to.
Yeah.
And that's kind of slowly how it happened. And then she ended up leaving. And I'm not totally sure how or when she left. But apparently, like, it stuck with her for a long time. Like, even though she would be like, yeah, that wasn't true, or was it? Is there this spacecraft that I should get on? Like,
yeah.
Because you believe it for so long.
And you've,
and other people believed it to such an extent, like they killed themselves to get on the damn spaceship.
Well, you have this trust that's built, and the trust, I think, is built initially on legitimate things. You know, and you get to the point of, well, I trust them on all these things. Why would they be lying to me about this? Or why would they, you know, why would some... And the thing is, the people, I mean, I don't think Marshall Applewhite, maybe I'm wrong when we get further in the story, I'll be proven wrong, but I don't think that he was trying to make it up. I think he believed it too, you know, as far as what I can tell, because I believe he died as well. But it's, you know, they end up having these delusional ideas, and then other people follow it because of the community that was created and the trust that was built. And yeah, I mean, that's how you start out at a flea market in Wichita, Kansas, getting your e-meter read, and you can tell about your stress levels. And then suddenly you're Kirstie Alley's slave. You know, I'm kidding.
She does live here.
Yeah, that's true. With the Scientology thing, but just how, you know, bizarre, you know, that can get. And suddenly you're believing there's, you know, this Xenu character and you were dropped into volcanoes and nuclear bombs went off and where the Thetans are in our bodies of these beings, and you know, that's Scientology, you know, in a small nutshell. But it starts out very innocent. It starts out very
can't start with the crazy shit.
No, because no one would join. And the thing is, half the people who are in these groups don't even know how dark and it gets, because a lot, I mean, especially the ones that adopt the pyramid scheme way of doing things, like Scientology or the Nexium. You gotta pay up to get to that level. And once you get to that level, you're like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, we're
not when you get to that level.
No, and you're so invested.
That's so much, literally. But like, I think in some of these other cults, more like the Heaven's Gate, you know, if this crazy guy is like, he totally believes it.
Yeah.
Like, and if someone's rather charismatic anyway, and then there's other people who are like, yeah, totally, we're waiting for the spaceship.
Yeah.
And slowly over time, and like, it was to the point, like, there was some other crazy shit that she was telling me about, like, they couldn't work and they couldn't ask people for anything. Mm-hmm. So they had to figure out how to get food and how to pay for things, but they couldn't ask anybody for anything. Like, they had weird rules they had to follow. So by all the weird rules and stuff, you kind of slowly, you know, it's in your head, well, I can't do that because there's the rule.
Yeah. It's conditioning.
You are.
It's crazy.
The next thing you know, you're waiting for the damn spaceship.
Yeah. It's the way you can condition and brainwash someone. What's scary to me is that just how susceptible people are. Given other cults had a hell of a lot more people than 39. So I'm kind of disappointed in their numbers, but still, 39 people, you can.
They had more people.
Yeah, it did. And I believe there's still like a version of it out there, if I'm right. We'll get into that in a little bit. But it's, you know, the fact that you convinced 39 people there was a spaceship coming behind Hale-Bopp, that's impressive in itself, too, of what the fuck you were able to do. But let's continue on here with the dark story of Marshall Applewhite and the Heaven's Gate cult. It just sounds like Marshall Applewhite. If he did something else, it could be like, that guy who sells grain, like Bob's Red Mill or something.
Right?
Marshall Applewhite's grits. Come and get some. Early life and education. Marshall Herf Applewhite Jr. was born in Spur, Texas on May 17th, 1931 to Marshall Herf Applewhite Sr. and his wife, Louise. He had three siblings, the son of a Presbyterian minister. Applewhite became very religious as a child. Applewhite attended Corpus Christi High School in Austin College. At a latter school, he was active in several student organizations and was moderately religious. He earned a bachelor's degree in philosophy in 1952 and subsequently enrolled at Union Presbyterian Seminary, to study theology, hoping to become a minister. He married Ann Pierce around that same time, and they later had two children, Mark and Lane. Early in his seminary studies, he decided to leave the school to pursue a career in music, becoming the music director of a Presbyterian church in North Carolina. He was a baritone singer and enjoyed spirituals and the music of Handel. In 1954, he was drafted by the United States Army and served in Austria and New Mexico as a member of the Army Signal Corps. He left the military in 1956 and enrolled at the University of Colorado, where he earned a master's degree in music and focused on music theater. Applewhite moved to New York City in an unsuccessful attempt to begin a professional singing career upon finishing his education in Colorado. He then taught at the University of Alabama. He lost his position there after pursuing a sexual relationship with a male student. His religious education was likely not supportive of same-sex relationships, and he was subsequently frustrated by his sexual desires. He separated from his wife when he learned of the affair in 1965, and they divorced 3 years later. After leaving the University of Alabama, Applewhite moved to Houston, Texas in 1965 to teach at the University of St. Thomas. His students regarded him as an engaging speaker and a stylish dresser. He served as chair of the music department. He became a locally popular singer, serving as the choral director of an Episcopal church and performing with the Houston Grand Opera. In Texas, he was briefly openly gay, but also pursued a relationship with a young woman who left him under pressure from her family, greatly upsetting him. He resigned from the University of St. Thomas in 1970, citing depression and other emotional problems. Robert Balch and David Taylor, sociologists who studied Applewhite's group, speculate that this departure was prompted by another affair between Applewhite and a student. The president of the university later recalled that he was often mentally jumbled and disorganized near the end of his employment. And in 1971, Applewhite briefly moved to New Mexico, where he operated a delicatessen. He was popular with customers, but decided to return to Texas later that year. His father died around that time. The loss took a significant emotional toll on him, causing severe depression. His debts mounted, forcing him to borrow money from friends. In 1972, Applewhite met Bonnie Nettles, a nurse with an interest in thespiany and biblical prophecy. The two quickly became close friends, and he later recalled that he felt like he had known her for a long time and concluded that they had met in a past life. She told him their meeting had been foretold to her by extraterrestrials, persuading him that he had a divine assignment. By that time, he had begun to investigate alternatives to traditional Christian doctrine, including astrology. He also had several visions, including one in which he was told that he was chosen for a role like that of Jesus. In her 2005 profile of Applewhite, Susan Rain speculates that he had a schizophrenic episode around this time. Applewhite soon began to live with Nettles. Although they cohabitated, their relationship was not a sexual one. Fulfilling his longtime wish to have a deep and loving yet platonic relationship, she was married with two children, but after she became close with Applewhite, her husband divorced her and she lost custody of her children. Applewhite permanently broke off contact with his family as well. He saw Nettles as his soulmate, and some of his acquaintances later recalled that she had a strong influence on him. Rain writes that Nettles was responsible for reinforcing his emerging delusional beliefs, but psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton speculates that Nettles' influence helped him avoid further psychological deterioration. Applewhite and Nettles opened a bookstore known as the Christian Arts Center, which carried books from a variety of spiritual backgrounds. They also launched a venture known as No Place to teach classes on mysticism and other things. They closed these businesses a short time later. In February of 1973, they resolved to travel to teach others about their beliefs and drove throughout the Southwest and Western United States. Lifton describes their travels as restless, intense, often confused, and a very strange spiritual journey. While traveling, they had little money and occasionally resorted to selling their blood or working odd jobs for much-needed funds. They subsisted solely on bread and rolls at times, often camped out and sometimes did not pay their lodging bills. One of their friends from Houston corresponded with them and accepted their teachings. They visited her in May of 1974, and she became their first convert. While traveling, Applewhite and Nettles pondered the life of St. Francis of Assisi and read works by authors, including Richard Bach. They kept a King James version of the Bible with them and studied several passages from the New Testament, focusing on teachings about Christology, Ascentism. Applewhite also read science fiction, including works by Robert A. Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke. By June of 1974, Applewhite and Nettles' beliefs had solidified into a basic outline. They concluded that they had been chosen to fulfill biblical prophecies and that they had been given higher-level minds than other people. They wrote a pamphlet that described Jesus' reincarnation as a Texan, a thinly-veiled reference to Applewhite. Furthermore, they concluded that they were the two witnesses described in the Book of Revelations and occasionally visited churches or other spiritual groups to speak of their identities, often referring to themselves as the Two or the UFO Two. They believed that they would be killed and then restored to life in view of others, transported into a spaceship. This event, which they referred to as the demonstration, was to prove their claims. To their dismay, these ideas were poorly received. In August of 1974, Applewhite was arrested in Harlington, Texas, for failing to return a car that had been rented in Missouri. He was extradited to St. Louis and jailed for 6 months. At the time, he maintained that he had been divinely authorized to keep the car. While in jail, he pondered theology and subsequently abandoned discussion of occult topics in favor of extraterrestrials and evolution. After Applewhite's release, Nettles and he resolved to contact extraterrestrials, and they sought like-minded followers. They published advertisements for meetings, which they recruited disciples who they called crew. At the events, they purported to represent beings from another planet. The Next Level, who sought participants for an experiment. They claimed that those who agreed to take part in the experiment would be brought to a higher evolutionary level. Nettles and he referred to themselves as Guinea and Pig. Applewhite described his role as a lab instructor and served as the primary speaker, while Nettles occasionally interjected clarifying remarks or corrections. The two seldom personally spoke with attendees, only taking phone numbers with which they could contact them. They initially named their organization the Anonymous Sexaholics Celibate Church, but it soon became known as the Human Individual Metamorphosis. Applewhite believed in the ancient astronaut Hippotheus, which claimed that extraterrestrials had visited humanity in the past and placed humans on Earth and would return to collect a select few. Parts of their teaching bear similarities to the Reformed Christian concept of election, likely owing to Applewhite's Presbyterian upbringing. He often discussed extraterrestrials using phasers from Star Trek and stated that aliens communicated with him through the show. Applewhite and Nettles sent advertisements to groups in California and were invited to speak to New Age devotees there in April of 1975. At this meeting, they persuaded about half of the 50 attendees to follow them. They also focused on college campuses, speaking at Canada College in August. At a meeting in Oregon in September 1975, they had further recruitment success. About 30 people left their homes to follow the pair, prompting interest from media outlets. The coverage was negative. Commentators also had some former members mocking the group and leveled accusations of brainwashing against Applewhite and Nettles. Blatch and Taylor state that Applewhite and Nettles eschewed pressure tactics, seeking only devoted followers. Benjamin E. Zeller, an academic who studies new religions, notes that Applewhite and Nettles' teachings focused on salvation through individual growth and sees this as similar to currents in the new era's age of movement. Likewise, the importance of personal choice was also emphasized. Applewhite and Nettles denied connection to the New Age movement, viewing it as human creation. Jenna Leelock, a sociologist who studies cults, attributes their recruitment success to their eclectic mix of beliefs and the way that they deviated from the typical New Age teachings, discussing literal spaceships while retaining familiar language. Most of their disciples were young and interested in occultism or otherwise lived outside of the mainstream society. They came from a variety of religious backgrounds, including Eastern religions and Scientology. Most were well-versed in New Age teachings, allowing Applewhite and Nettles to convert them easily. Applewhite thought that his followers would reach a higher level of being, changing like a caterpillar, becoming a butterfly. This example was used almost in all of their literature. Applewhite contended that this would be a biological change into a different species, casting his teachings as scientific truth in line with secular naturalism. He emphasized to his early followers that he was not speaking metamorphically, often using the words biology and chemistry in his statements. By the mid-1970s, he attempted to avoid the term religion, saying it is inferior to science. Although he dismissed religion as unscientific, he sometimes emphasized the need for faith in the aliens' abilities to transform them. So, I think what would have lost me is where he was getting messages while watching Star Trek.
Well, that's just one of many things. There's a lot. But, you know, you have to wonder, had he not met Bonnie Nettles.
Yeah.
Now, she sounds like a nurse in the 50s or a schoolmarm.
Yeah.
Had he not met her... Because they kind of fed off each other, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know? And so they developed this weird shit together. You have to wonder, had he not met her, I don't think he'd have been normal by any means.
No. But would they have individually been able to get the mental help that they needed to not be on this delusional path? It's like you had two people. It was a perfect storm. Yeah, it was a perfect storm of two people that just, when you have the reinforcement back and forth, they're just playing ping pong of insanity. And then eventually it's like, hey, let's play doubles. And then they started adding more people into the ping pong of insanity.
Exactly. And then when it's a two of them.
Yeah.
And they're talking this weird shit, but they so believe it. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever really been around someone who's having a serious psychotic break.
Mm-mm.
It's bizarre. Like, they'll look right at you. And it's like,
yeah,
yeah, you know, that's exactly what's happening. And they're going to break into my house and they're going to do these horrible things. And you're like, no, they're not. They're really not.
Yeah.
Nobody out there.
Yeah, but there's no reasoning. There's no reasoning with that individual.
Yeah. And it's like, because I've had it happen with a couple of people I know really well.
Yeah.
And it was like, as they're talking, they believe it 100%. Like these are people that I know really well and I would believe anything except this. It's like, they're right. The infiltration did not happen then.
Yeah.
And so like, I get how someone could look right at you and be so convinced. Then when you have someone with them that is convincing as they are, that could be a lot, you know, if you found the right people, then you find one person to agree with you and another person. And
thus far, I have to say, of all the cults that we've discussed on the show, I'm really not impressed with his tactics of recruitment. I'm not. I mean, I'm not surprised it took a long time to get people.
At first.
What's that?
It really wasn't. There wasn't much of a tactic.
No.
Other than they're spreading the word.
Well, it's just like, let's go to churches and tell people that we're, you know, coming back from revelations. And
yeah.
It's just like, that's not going to fly in most churches. It's not really the place I think you're going to recruit a lot of people. I mean,
but I don't even think it probably at that point it was about recruiting. It was about, we have to tell them.
Yeah, you're probably right. It was just, it was just more get our message out. And then,
yeah.
You know, let's see if they up their game.
They did.
Well, they did a little, at least. I mean, 39 is what ended up going down on the crazy ship. But it's just, I don't know. I mean, there's I get a lot of cults and I can understand like, oh, okay, that's how that worked. With this guy, it's like, I don't know, you really had to do some picking here to get followers. And clearly they weren't right. To follow some of this stuff, because I mean, other ones are at least somewhat convincing in terms of a cult. This is like, and I'm getting messages from Star Trek. You are okay. I'm out. You know. So let's continue on the story of Marshall Applewhite and the Heaven's Gate cult. By 1975, Applewhite and Nettles had taken the names Bo and Peep. They had about 70 followers and saw themselves as shepherds tending a flock. Applewhite believed that complete separation from earthly desires was a prerequisite of ascension to the next level, and emphasized passages in the New Testament in which Jesus spoke about forsaking worldly attachments. Members were consequently instructed to renounce friends, family, media, drugs, alcohol, jewelry, facial hair, and sexuality. Furthermore, they were required to adopt biblical names. Applewhite and Nettles soon told them to adopt two-syllable names that ended in Adi and had three consonants in the first syllable, such as Rock Adi, Jim Adi, and Love Adi. Applewhite stated that these names emphasized that his followers were spiritual children. Applewhite, Nettles, and their followers lived as what religious scholar James Lewis describes as a quasi-nomadic lifestyle. They usually stayed at remote campgrounds and did not speak about their beliefs. Applewhite and Nettles ceased having public meetings in April of 1975 and spent little time teaching doctrine to their converts. The leaders also had little contact with their dispersed followers, many of whom renounced their allegiance. Applewhite and Nettles feared that they would be assassinated and taught their followers that their deaths would be similar to those of the two witnesses in the Book of Revelations. Block and Taylor believe that Applewhite's prison experience and early rejection by audience contributed to his fear. Applewhite and Nettles later explained to their followers that the former's treatment by the press was a form of assassination and it fulfilled their prophecy. Applewhite took a materialistic view of the Bible, seeing it as a record of extraterrestrial contact with humanity. He drew heavily from the Book of Revelations, although he avoided traditional theological terminology and took a somewhat negative tone towards Christianity. He only lectured about a small number of verses and never tried to develop a system of theology. By early 1976, Applewhite and Nettles had settled on the names Dew and Tea. Applewhite stated that these were meaningless names. In June of 1976, they gathered their remaining followers at Medicine Bow National Forest in southeastern Wyoming, promising a UFO visit. Nettles later announced that the visit had been canceled. Applewhite and Nettles then split their followers into small groups, which they referred to as star clusters. From 1976 to 1979, the group lived in campgrounds, usually in the Rocky Mountains or Texas. Applewhite and Nettles began to place greater demands on their followers to loosely state in structured lives, which improved membership retention. They typically communicated with their disciples in writing or through assistants. Increasingly, they emphasized that they were the only source of truth. The idea that members could receive individual revelations was rejected in an attempt to prevent others from leaving the group. Applewhite also thought to prevent close friendships among his followers, fearing that this could lead to insubordination. Applewhite and Nettles insisted that their followers practice what they referred to as flexibility, strict obedience to their often shifting requests. The two leaders limited the group's contact to those outside the movement, even some who may have been interested in joining, obstinately to prevent infiltration from hostile parties. In practice, this made their followers completely dependent upon them. Applewhite instructed his disciples to be like children or pets in their submission. Their sole responsibility was to obey their leaders. Members were encouraged to constantly seek Applewhite's advice and often ask themselves what their leaders would do when making a decision. To his followers, he did not seem dictatorial at all. Many of them found him laid back and fatherly. In his 2000 study of the group, Winston Davis states that Applewhite mastered the fine art of religious entertainment, noting that many of his disciples seemed to enjoy their service. Applewhite organized seemingly arbitrary rituals that were intended to instill a sense of discipline in his followers. He referred to these tasks as games. He also watched science fiction television programs with the rest of the group. Rather than issue direct commands, he attempted to express his preferences of nominally offer his disciples a choice. He emphasized that students were free to disobey if they chose in what Leelock dubs as the illusion of choice. In the late 1970s, the group received a large sum of money, possibly an inheritance of a member or donations of followers' income. The capital was used to rent houses, initially in Denver and later in Dallas. Applewhite and Nettles had about 40 followers then and lived in two or three houses. The leaders usually had their own house. The group was secretive about their lifestyle, covering their windows. Applewhite and Nettles arranged their followers' lifestyles as a boot camp that would prepare them for the next level, referring to their house as a craft. They regimented their lives of their disciples to the minute. Students who were not committed to the lifestyle were encouraged to leave. Departing members were given financial assistance. Lifton states that Applewhite wanted quality over quantity in his followers, although he occasionally spoke against gaining many converts. Applewhite and Nettles sometimes made sudden drastic changes to the group. On one occasion in Texas, they told their followers of a forthcoming visitation from extraterrestrials and instructed them to wait outside all night, at which point they informed them that this had been merely a test. Leelock sees this as a way that they increased their students' devotion, ensuring that their commitment became irrespective of what they saw. Members became desperate for Applewhite's approval, which he used to control them. In 1980, Applewhite and Nettles had about 80 followers, many of whom held jobs, often working with computers or car mechanics. In 1982, Applewhite and Nettles allowed their disciples to call their families. They further relaxed the control in 1983, permitting their followers to visit relatives on Mother's Day. They were only allowed short stays and were instructed to tell their families that they were studying computers at a monastery. These vacations were intended to placate families by demonstrating that the disciples remained with the group on their own accord. And in 1983, Nettles had an eye surgically removed as a result of cancer diagnosed several years earlier. She lived for two more years, dying in 1985. Applewhite told their followers that she had traveled to the next level because she had too much energy to remain on Earth, abandoning her body to make the journey. His attempt to explain her death in terms of the group's doctrine was successful, preventing the departure of all but one member. Applewhite became very depressed. He claimed that Nettles still communicated with him, but he suffered from a crisis of faith. His students supported him during this time, greatly encouraging him, and he then organized a ceremony in which he symbolically married his followers. Lilac views this as an attempt to ensure unity. Applewhite told his followers that he had been left behind by Nettles because he still had more to learn, and he felt that she occupied a higher spiritual role than he did. He began identifying her as the Father and often referred to her with male pronouns. Applewhite began to emphasize a strict hierarchy, teaching that his students needed his guidance as he needed the guidance of the next level. Zeller notes that this naturally ensured no possibility of the group's continuing if Applewhite were to die. A relationship with Applewhite was said to be the only way to salvation. He encouraged his followers to see him as Christ. Zeller states that the group's previous focus on individual choice was replaced with an emphasis on Applewhite's role as mediator. Applewhite maintained some aspects of their scientific teachings, but in the 1980s, the group became more like a religion in its focus on faith and submission to authority. After Nettles' death, Applewhite also altered his view of ascension. Previously, he had thought that the group would physically ascend from the earth and that death caused reincarnation, but her death, which left behind an unchanged corporeal body, forced him to say that the ascension could be spiritual. He then concluded that her spirit had traveled to a spaceship and received a new body, and that his followers and he would do the same. In his view, the biblical heaven was actually a planet on which highly evolved beings dwelt, and physical bodies were required to ascend there. Applewhite believed that one day they reached the next level, they would facilitate evolution on other planets. He emphasized that Jesus, whom he believed was an extraterrestrial, came to Earth, was killed, and bodily rose from the dead before being transported onto a spaceship. According to Applewhite's doctrine, Jesus was a gateway to heaven, but had found humanity unready to ascend when he first came to Earth. Applewhite then decided that an opportunity existed for humans to reach the next level every two millennia, and the early 1990s would therefore provide the first opportunity to reach the kingdom of heaven since the time of Jesus. Zeller notes that his beliefs were based on the Christian Bible, but were interpreted through the lens of belief in alien contact with humanity. Applewhite taught that he was a walk-in, a concept that had gained popularity in the New Age movement during the late 1970s. Walk-ins were said to be higher beings who took control of adult bodies to teach humanity. This concept informed Applewhite's view of resurrection. He believed that his group's souls were to be transported to a spaceship where they would enter other bodies. Applewhite abandoned that metaphor of a butterfly in favor of describing the body as a mere container, a vehicle that souls could enter and exit. This dualism may have been the product of Christology that Applewhite learned as a young man. Lewis writes that the group's teachings had Christian elements, were basically grafted on to a New Age matrix. In a profile of the group for Newsweek, Kenneth Woodward compares his dualism to that of ancient Christian beliefs, although Peters notes that his theology departs from several of them by privileging the physical world. In the wake of Nettles' death, Applewhite became increasingly paranoid, fearing a conspiracy against his group. One member who joined in the mid-1980s recalled that Applewhite avoided new converts, worrying that they were infiltrators. He feared a government raid on their home and spoke highly of the Jewish defenders of Masada in ancient Israel, who showed total resistance to the Roman Empire. Increasingly, he began to discuss the apocalypse, comparing the earth to an overgrown garden that was to be recycled or rebooted and humanity a failed experiment. In accordance with the garden metaphor, he stated that the earth would be spaded under. Woodward notes that Applewhite's teaching about the earth's recycling is similar to the cyclical perspective of time found in Buddhism. Applewhite also used New Age concepts, but the different from what movement by preceding that apocalyptic rather than utopian changes would soon occur on Earth. He contended that most humans had been brainwashed by Lucifer and that his followers could break free of this control. He specifically cited sexual urges as the work of Lucifer. In addition, he stated that evil extraterrestrials who were referred to as Luciferians thought to thwart his mission. He argued that many prominent moral teachers and advocates of political correctness were actually Luciferians. This theme emerged in 1988, possibly in response to the lurid alien abduction stories that were being profiled at the time. So there we get a good glimpse into the world of Heaven's Gate up into that point as we're getting closer and closer to Kool-Aid time or whatever they used with the Nikes. Or I will get into all that shortly.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that part.
Yeah, but it's just this random mix of weirdness. I mean, I guess that's why it wasn't that big of a following. And I get where he's saying, you know, I prefer smaller groups over larger groups. I don't think he had a choice in the matter. I think there's a lot of people who were, you know, I'm out. And he didn't really seem to chase after them. There was no like, oh, you can't leave because we have shit on you. As you see in some other groups today, it was more like, fine, you don't want to be here, then get out. We only want to keep the ones who believe this batshit crazy stuff. It's a fascinating one of even the fact that they were able to gain as many as they did. I still stand by that one.
And I just think it's kind of a slow process.
Yeah.
And he had an answer for everything. So if you're going to buy any of it, then, you know, if you can buy into any point of that crazy stuff as he's going along and then like she dies and it's like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. And he's like, oh, because she was farther along and she needed to go or whatever bullshit, you know, it's like he was able to keep it going.
It makes me wonder how many of the ones who died when they did the mass suicide were original members, or was this always a revolving door of people where you only had like so many at a certain, you know, cause you can't maintain that level of crazy.
Although once you buy in, I mean, it's going to take a lot.
And I think he brought a lot. He brought a lot to that game of crazy.
Yeah. So once you've bought in so far, like, and you really do think there's an alien spaceship and you do think she died and now she's some God, him sort of figure.
Yeah.
All of the things. Like, at what point do you go, that one's too far?
That's the thing. There's just so many things in his story where it's like, really? This is what you said then? I mean, it would be like, you know, somebody who's super into football or something, suddenly one weekend they're like, you know what? We're not using footballs anymore. We're using cats. And it's like, what? You're doing what? No, I can't support that.
No, but they're like, no, but we're still playing the game, right?
It's a cat, though. It's from the Humane Society. We got a couple extra here. It's like, no, we're not. I mean, it's like it would turn everyone off. There would be nobody be like, yeah, let's do fucking cats. You know, I mean, there's probably a couple nutcases out there, but that's how you have such a small group. But the mass majority that have been like with you forever would be like, no, this is, I don't think so. You may attract a whole new group of NFL fans who never cared about football if you suddenly started playing with cats. Obviously. Yeah. But it's just like, he just makes so many twists and turns that are so like, what? That I don't know how you maintain that group, but I'm curious.
Like the Scientology, like, you know, they keep going up that ladder, whatever they call that. And people are spending more and more, like outrageous sums of money to get to this level of, you don't even really know what that level is, but nobody really attains it.
Unless you're
go talk to somebody who got to that.
Unless you're Tom Cruise, and then you got it.
Keep on giving them money.
I know.
And they keep going with it because at some point I think you're so invested that can you really admit to yourself, like, man, I really did believe that spaceship was coming.
Yeah. You
know, it's like,
well, it's a cult of belief, and I think we have it today in our political system. I think we've always had it to a certain level in our political system, but it's more evident today than ever. And I'm not going to go on here and say this side or that side, but it's very much like there is no way you are going to convince me otherwise, no matter what. Even when you have just hard facts and shit, like, no, this is factual. This is what this is. And where you can't break it. And to me, I'm just like, I'm always looking to be proven wrong. And I like that, because then I'm learning something and I look for it. I like to be wrong, but it's I don't think most people's attitude. You know, I have very strong opinions on things, but if I'm wrong on something and I can be proven wrong, more power to you that you taught me something I didn't know. Then that can elevate me to a different level of thinking of where I was before, because I was stuck on that. I want to learn more. But I don't think that is necessarily how I think we're brought up. We're brought up to follow for the most part. We're not really brought up to let's keep evolving and learning more. But a lot of these cults, you know, they almost disguise themselves as we're going to take you to a new level. We're going to take you someplace different. So it can be very, I think, attractive. The ones that aren't in this blatantly batshit crazy right off the bat, it can be attractive to a mind like that, because you're like, ooh, this is self-help. This is, you know, self-education. I was curious about Scientology a little bit when I was younger, because I was interested in the self-help angle of it. I never joined or anything, but I read a book about it. And then I started doing my research and going, oh, these people are fucking nuts. But it was like, this is how they get people in. But initially, a lot of those kind of self-help things, same with Nexium and things of that nature, it sounds sexy. It sounds interesting at first. Like, this is going to better you. And you can learn. And then it's like, oh, wait a second. Now you're supposed to have sex with a leader and a cat. And it's like, okay, leader, one thing, cat, that's a bridge too far.
But I think that so many people find a community.
Yeah.
And these are people who don't have, and you know, like this one. Like the whole thing about they could go home on Mother's Day, or was it go home or call?
Go home. Something. Imagine
they
that
could
day.
Do that. So there was a little bit of contact to keep their families away from them.
Can you imagine the dinner table discussion at the Golden Corral on that Mother's Day with your child that came out of the Heaven's Gate cult just for Mother's Day only? You know, that would just be really bizarre as you're having your crab salad. It would just,
Oh my God, I would never eat crab salad. Not that I would anyway, vegetarian, but at Golden Corral. So
true.
With all respect to Golden Corral,
true story.
It just doesn't seem like a dish I think that would be good.
I've eaten at a Golden Corral twice in my life. And Harper really, when she was younger, this idea of buffets was amazing to her, because she was
Tony, like, I ate five. The last Thanksgiving
I know,
day.
I know you do. Golden's why I brought it up, because you go to a Golden
Day. It was the saddest
I know.
Holiday season of my life.
You tend to end up at like Golden Corrals and Ryan's on holidays.
My mother.
I know.
Like, oh, that sounds good.
Because your mom wants to go to these places. And that's what I find funny.
Just to do it.
I know. But I know.
Like, this is the most pathetic holiday season ever, that both major holidays I hate a Golden Corral. And a vegetarian. And so it was like,
at least there's options.
They have their crappy salad bar and some mashed potatoes.
Yep. I did try the crab salad, and it's imitation crab. And it's honestly, it's not half bad.
Okay.
And it's so not half bad that they actually, I was looking at the decor of the Golden Corral when I was there, and there are signs on their walls with the recipes of certain items that people apparently really like there. And one of them is the crab salad. And I'm just like, wow. So you can go home and make Golden Corral food at home. That's on my bucket list. But I do, you know, honestly.
There you are. Yeah. And the woman's bringing, your waiter's bringing you your drinks. And you're like, man, I love this crab salad. Can I get the recipe? And they're like, it's posted over by the ladies' room.
It's go right over there. Just go over there. Go by the ladies' room with your camera out. And nothing
take
weird.
Picture that recipe.
Nothing weird about that at all. And I'm getting stairs having your camera out as women are walking out of the restroom. Yeah, that's Golden Corral for you. Let's continue on with the story here. Next week's episode is Golden Corral, actually, on the Dark Side of Wicked.
No,
I'm kidding. In the late 1980s, the group kept a low profile. Few people knew it still existed. In 1988, they mailed a document that detailed their beliefs to a variety of New Age organizations. The mailing contained information about their history and advised people to read several books, which primarily focused on Christian history and UFOs. With the exception of the 1988 document, Applewhite's group remained inconspicuous until 1992, when they recorded a 12-part video series which was broadcast via satellite. This series echoed many of the teachings of the 1988 update, although it introduced a universal mind of which its hearers could partake. Over the course of the group's existence, several hundred people joined and left. In the early 1990s, their membership dwindled, numbering as few as 26. These defections gave Applewhite a sense of urgency. In May of 1993, the group took the name Total Overcomers Anonymous. They then spent $30,000 to publish a full-page advertisement in USA Today that warned of catastrophic judgment to befall the Earth. Its publication led about 20 former members to rejoin the group. This, along with a series of public lectures in 1994, caused membership to double from its nadir at the beginning of the decade. By this time, Applewhite did not regiment his disciples' lives as strictly as he had and spent less time with them. In the early 1990s, Applewhite posted some of his teachings on the internet, but he was stung by the resulting criticism. That year, he first spoke of the possibility of suicide as a way to reach the next level. He explained that everything human had to be forsaken, including the human body, before one could ascend. The organization was then renamed Heaven's Gate. Davis speculates that this rejection may have encouraged him to attempt to leave Earth. From June to October of 1995, the group lived in a rural part of New Mexico. They purchased 40 acres and built a compound, which they referred to as the Earth Ship, using tires and lumber. Applewhite hoped to establish a monastery. This proved to be a difficult endeavor, particularly for the aging Applewhite. He was in poor health and at one point feared that he had cancer. Lifton notes that Applewhite's active leadership of the group probably led to severe fatigue in his last years. The winter was very cold and they abandoned the plan. Afterwards, they lived in several houses in the San Diego area. The group increasingly focused on the suppression of sexual desire. Applewhite and seven others opted for surgical castration. They initially had difficulty finding a willing surgeon, but eventually found one in Mexico. In Applewhite's view, sexuality was one of the most powerful forces that bound humans to their bodies and thus hindered their efforts to evolve to the next level. He taught that next-level beings had no reproductive organs, but that Luciferian beings had genders. He also cited a verse of the New Testament that said that there would not be marriage in heaven. In addition, he required members to adopt similar clothing and haircuts, possibly to reinforce that they were non-sexual family. In October of 1996, the group rented a mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, California. That year, they recorded two video messages in which they offered their viewers a last chance to evacuate Earth. Around the same time, they learned of the approach of Comet Hale-Bopp. Applewhite now believed that Nettles was aboard a spaceship trailing the comet and that she planned to rendezvous with them. He told his followers that the vessel would transport them to the Eprian destination, that a government conspiracy was attempting to suppress word of the craft. In addition, he stated that his deceased followers would be taken by the vessel as well, a belief that resembled the Christian rapture doctrine. How he learned of the comet or why he believed that it was accompanied by extraterrestrials or why he should have believed the dead Nettles would be with him is not known. In late March of 1997, the group isolated themselves and recorded farewell statements. Many members praised Applewhite in their final message. Davis describes their remarks as regurgitations of Dew's gospel. Applewhite recorded a video shortly before his death in which he termed the suicides the final exit of the group and remarked, "We do, in all honesty, hate this world." Lewis speculates that Applewhite settled on suicide because he had said that the group would ascend during his lifetime, so appointing a successor was unfeasible. Religious scholar Catherine Wessinger points that the suicides began on March 22nd. Most members took barbiturates and alcohol and then placed bags over their heads. They wore Nike shoes and black uniforms with patches that read Heaven's Gate Away Team. A bag that contained a few dollars in a form of identification was placed beside most bodies. The death occurred over 3 days. Applewhite was one of the last four to die. Three assistants helped him die by suicide, then killed themselves. An anonymous tip led to the sheriff's department search of the mansion, where they found 39 bodies on March 26. It was the largest group suicide involving U.S. citizens since the 1978 mass suicide of 920 Americans in Jonestown. Applewhite's body was found seated on the head of the mansion's master bedroom. Medical examiners determined that his fears of cancer had been unfounded, but that he suffered from coronary issues. The deaths provoked a media circus, and Applewhite's face was featured on the cover of Time and Newsweek on April 7th. His final message was widely broadcast. Hugh Urban of Ohio State University described his appearance in the video as wide-eyed and rather alarming. Although many popular commentators, including psychologist Margaret Singer, speculate that Applewhite brainwashed his followers, many academics have rejected the brainwashing label as an oversimplification that does not express the nuances of the process by which the followers were influenced. Lilac speculates that they were willing to follow Applewhite in suicide because they had become totally dependent on him, hence were poorly suited for life in his absence. Davis attributes Applewhite's success in convincing his followers to die by suicide the two factors. He isolated them and socially cultivated an attitude of complete religious obedience in them. Applewhite's students had made a long-term commitment to him, and Block and Taylor infer that this is why his interpretations of events appeared coherent to them. Most of the dead had been members for about 20 years, although there were a few recent converts. Lewis argues that Applewhite effectively controlled his followers by packaging his teachings in familiar terms. Richard Hecht of the University of California, Santa Barbara, echoes this sentiment, arguing that members of the group killed themselves because they believed the narrative that he had constructed rather than because he psychologically controlled them. In his 2000 study of apocalyptic movements, John R. Hall posits that they were motivated to die by suicide because they saw it as a way to demonstrate that they had conquered the fear of death and truly believed Applewhite. Urban writes that Applewhite's life displays the intense ambivalence and alienation shared by many individuals lost in late 20th century capitalist society. He notes that Applewhite's condemnations of contemporary culture bear similarity to those of others and others in time, particularly shared nihilist views. Urban posts that Applewhite found no way other than suicide to escape the society that surrounded him and states that death offered him a way to escape its endless circle of seduction and consumption. While covering the suicide, several media outlets focused on Applewhite's sexuality. The New York Post dubbed him the gay guru. Gay rights activist Troy Perry argued that Applewhite's repression and society's rejection of same-sex relationships ultimately led to his suicide. This idea has failed to gain support among academics. Zeller argues that Applewhite's sexuality was not the primary driving force behind his asceticism, which he believes resulted from a variety of factors, though he grants the sexuality a role. Lilac states that Applewhite fit the traditional view of a charismatic leader, and Evan Thomas deems him a master manipulator. Lifton compares Applewhite to Shaco Ashera, the founder of Om Shikharu, describing him as equally controlling, his paranoia and megalomania gentler yet ever present. Christopher Partridge of Lancaster University states that Applewhite and Nettles were similar to John Reeve and others who founded another religion, a millennialist movement in the 17th century England. Lane Applewhite Sanez, Marshall Applewhite's daughter, is the mother of Hannah Overton, the Corpus Christi woman who was accused of poisoning her adopted son, Andrew Byrd. Overton was cleared on appeal in 2017. Lane was also married to Hannah's father, the Reverend Bernie Sanez, who was an evangelical preacher in Corpus Christi. Reverend Sanez was convicted in 1984 of the bludgeoning death of a 16-year-old girl whose nude body was discovered on Padre Island. He was sentenced to 23 years in prison. Well, when that's your dad, I think you have to kind of...
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. But you kind of have to go, yeah,
I don't know that you're set up, you know, with the best path in life or genes.
I can't imagine having to live with that.
No.
That's who you came from.
You got to feel bad for someone who that's the cards you're dealt.
Well, no wonder he decided that aliens and spaceships were a better option.
I'm just amazed. He had 20 people that stayed with him for like 20 years.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Because my guess was that it was going to be a
once you've bought in,
yeah,
you bought in.
You really bought into that one, yeah.
Like, really?
That is quite an interesting story. I mean, I always knew the Cliff Notes, but I've never gone through the whole entry into the great detail of that. I've always been fascinated with it. I was new in radio at that time. It was 97. It was my second year, I think. But I just remember it being a news story. And like,
you were 12.
Yeah, exactly. I was 15, actually. And that's not a joke. I remember reading some of that stuff on the air as it was happening. And, you know, it was just like, I was working in rock radio, too. So I remember we made a lot of jokes about it. But it was...
Which, thinking back on that, like, that really is...
It was sad.
Weird that you were joking about that.
I know.
You know what
I mean? I know.
It's not really funny.
It isn't. It isn't, but at the time, people were making a lot of jokes about it because of how the strange video the guy put out. The internet was new at the time, for the most part. They had a web page, which was like, ooh, any reason someone could go on the internet was kind of a thing. So everybody was trying to go to this Heaven's Gate website, which I believe still exists if you go to the Internet Archive. And there was just so many weird things about it that people felt no fear to make fun. I mean, even there's some people that died, which is sad and screwed up. But I guess sometimes, you know, when things are just so screwed up, it's like the humanity of it, people lose for some reason. And they're just like, well, you know, they're that crazy. But, you know, people weren't exactly, you know, diving into the psychology of it at the time. But when you look at it, it's just, it's fascinating. It's not something to joke about, but it's like, geez, this is just so...
It's so batshit crazy.
It is. It's totally batshit crazy. But, you know, I always make light of dark shit, but that's why this show exists. Dark side of Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you have to kind of, I think, process a lot of it. But I like it because we examine the stuff. We're able to put some humor to it to kind of be able to absorb it, but we are absorbing it and we're kind of working our way through different ideas and thoughts and try to figure out, well, how the hell were these people thinking and how did this all actually go down? And that's what I find interesting about this show. So there you go. Marshall Applewhite and the Heaven's Gate Cult. The more you know. Do-do-do-do. And that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, help us stay on the air. Give us a review there on Apple Podcasts. Let your friends know that we exist. We greatly, greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.